Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, an airliner down and the inescapable echo of September 11th. This morning at 9:17 a.m., American Airlines Flight 587 crashed in Queens, New York, just minutes after taking off from Kennedy Airport. The FAA is treating the crash as an accident, not as a terrorist attack. But that doesn't change what many Americans thought when they first heard the news. It's happening again. First, New York's response to this latest tragedy. Joining us now is reporter Marianne McCune, who's covering the story for WNYC. Hello, Marianne.
Hi.
So what's the latest? How many bodies have been recovered at this point? How many are missing? And what did this sad ground zero look like compared to the World Trade Center?
Well, I just got back from the crash site where firefighters were still recovering bodies from the wreckage. But in a press briefing earlier this morning, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani said about 225 bodies have already been recovered. I'm sure more have been recovered since that time. That was around 6:20. And there were 255 people aboard the plane. So, and in addition, on the ground, it looks like 6 to 8 residents of the Rockaway area of Queens are still unaccounted for. I spoke to one 17-year-old high school student who lived on the block that was hit, and he said he knows a girl down the street from him whose father was sleeping upstairs in their house when the plane hit and their house caught fire. And apparently part of that house collapsed, and she doesn't know yet where her father is. As far as how it's different from Ground Zero, I mean, in some ways it looks similar. In the morning there was smoke. Some people said a mile high and huge flames and, of course, debris from the plane crash. And then the same story of bodies and body parts being dragged out of the disaster site. But it's also very different because the scale is obviously much smaller. There are no huge buildings crashing down. And it's a residential area with mostly 1- and 2-story houses. So a lot of people responded by coming out with their garden hoses and trying to aid the firefighters in putting out the flames.
How many houses were actually affected by the impact and the fire, Marianne?
The main portion of the plane fell on about 12 houses, 4 of which were totally destroyed, and there was varying damage to the others. One of the plane engines fell into a gas station in the area, and the other fell a few blocks away in someone's backyard, and some neighbors told me that they'd seen it and that it crushed part of the house's back porch and the boat that they had in their driveway. It was just this huge piece of engine.
And we have reports that there are the suitcases and luggage and, of course, human remains throughout the
neighborhood. Exactly. And some neighbors told me, one neighbor told me she'd found a seat belt on the ground. Another said that on her front lawn there was a big piece of metal. She didn't know what part of the plane it was, but officials were telling them to leave it there because it's part of the disaster scene and they need to use that kind of evidence to figure out what happened.
Investigators are calling it an accident. What about the crash leads them to believe that this crash was caused by mechanical failure?
Well, you're right. The head of the National Transportation Safety Board has said that all of the information so far points toward an accident. There have been a number of documented failures involving the family of CF6 General Electric engines on the plane, though none to date involved fatalities. But the NTSB apparently warned less than a year ago that such an in-flight failure could cause a plane to crash, so investigators seem to be focusing now on the engine that broke away from the plane. The flight data recorder has been recovered and is now in D.C. being analyzed by NTSB investigators and the other black box containing the voice recordings that hasn't been recovered yet.
You spent a good deal of your day talking to firefighters and members of the community in Rockaway. How are the firefighters holding up in this latest disaster? A lot of them were in the same community that took the hit at the World Trade Center.
Right. I definitely saw a lot of bleak expressions on the faces of firefighters and emergency medical technicians as well. Some of them told me that this day seemed even harder than September 11th because of its memory and the idea of running into a disaster when you don't know how big it could be or become. One firefighter said he was running in thinking, you know, maybe there was something on the plane that might still explode, you know, that it was on the ground now. So I think they definitely had a newfound sense of danger. And, of course, counselors have told me over and over since September 11th that when something traumatic happens, people who've suffered other traumas recently have a harder time dealing with it. And New York's entire population of firefighters have suffered some pretty severe trauma recently.
So well, and New Yorkers have in general. What about the response of the city overall? What signs did you see of how the city's taking this new tragedy on board?
Well, I was mainly out in that Rockaway area, and that neighborhood was really hard hit by the September 11th attacks. As I said, there are a lot of firefighters and police who live in that neighborhood. And then there are also quite a few investment banker types, some of whom worked in the World Trade Center. So Rockaway has lost dozens of people in the attacks. There have been funerals there every week. People were telling me they just couldn't believe tragedy could come any closer to their doorsteps than here a plane crashes in their neighborhood.
How strange, strange fate is if this was indeed an accident. We also understand that almost all the passengers were Dominican, many from the Manhattan area. Did you get any sense today of the response of the Dominican community there?
Yeah, there are about 407,000 people of Dominican descent in New York, and community leaders project that something like 80 to 90% of the people on board were of Dominican descent. So it's an enormous loss for this group. A lot of Dominican Americans in New York have been talking about how closely linked people are to their families in the Dominican Republic, and as a result, people travel back and forth quite often, and this American Airlines flight is an extremely popular one. So community groups and elected officials in the area of Washington Heights, where a lot of Dominicans live, say they've been inundated with calls from grieving relatives and concerned neighbors. And a community group in the Washington Heights neighborhood of Manhattan called Alianza Dominicana is setting up its own counseling and support services for people connected with their organization.
Marianne, what are we looking for tomorrow in terms of the investigation and announcements or new steps that might be forthcoming?
I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot from the National Transportation Safety Board, and Mayor Giuliani has been very vigilant about keeping the city and the country informed about what's going on since the World Trade Center attack on September 11th, so I'm sure we'll be hearing more from him and more from the Dominican community.
Marianne, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks.
Marianne McCune is a reporter at WNYC in New York. As New Yorkers woke up for their early morning commute, the lead story on the war on terror was that rebel forces had captured the Afghan city of Talikan. Then came the news that an American Airlines commercial jet had crashed in a residential neighborhood in Queens. In what may be bitter irony, another tragedy in New York unsettled a nation just beginning to cope with the emotional wounds of September 11th. Preliminary reports indicate the crash was not an act of terrorism, but for many Americans, it's just another reminder of the vulnerability and uncertainty terrorism has produced. What was your reaction to this morning's news? Where are we in the psychological cycle of terror? Are the steps that America has taken for homeland defense enough? You can join our conversation this evening at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now in the studio is Juliet Kayyem. She's executive director of the Domestic Preparedness Program at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. She's an expert on counterterrorism and national security. Good evening, Juliet Kayyem.
Good evening.
And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Juliet Kayyem, so here we are. We're told at this point that it's an accident, it's mechanical failure, as bizarre and strange as it sounds that it could happen in the same city that had September 11th hit it. But yet, I'm sure that many others, like the people in my household early this morning, were watching that plume of smoke over New York and saying, my God, here it is again. It's terrorism. And now, from the distance of some, 12 hours or so, I feel kind of trapped in this terror mentality. Right. Is that what happens? How does the feeling of the nation and of individuals today relate to patterns of the psychology of terror playing out?
Well, we know we've come a long way since September 11th, when the disaster that happened today, a lot of us sort of felt some ease, if not appreciation, that it wasn't, in fact, terrorism, even though over 300 people died. We're glad to hear that it may just be an average plane accident. It sort of tells you how far we've come since the 11th. After the 11th, everything and anything seems possible. We've been inundated not just with the images of September 11th, but, of course, the continuing anthrax scare and then a war abroad that may not be as visual as stuff going on here, but certainly raises concern about what could happen here. And I think that we're a nation on edge, and to be quite honest, it's not a bad thing to be on edge for a while, so long as the military conflict continues and it's yet unresolved, sort of how this war on terrorism is going to end. I think we need to start getting used to this sort of heightened sense of concern, heightened sense of security or insecurity, and to go from there.
How strange it must appear to the terrorists themselves, who clearly put a lot of planning into September 11th. Mm-hmm. And then in the aftermath, first we have these anthrax attacks, mm-hmm. which many people are saying may not be related to Al-Qaeda and mm-hmm. Osama bin Laden's operation. And now what looks to be a mechanical failure that brings down an airliner in the same city, this must look like it's playing into their hands so amazingly.
Right, without much work on their part. I mean, if it's true what we're starting to hear, that anthrax may be the work of a lone person here on American soil, although we don't know what his ethnicity would be or where he comes from, and then this event today with the American Airlines flight, they're getting a lot of play out of sort of other things that are happening, and it does play into the kind of terror that they want to reap on American citizens and society. What's different about this and, say, I would say like Israel or other countries that often face terrorism on a daily basis is that the terrorists that we're facing now, we don't really know how to respond to them. It's not like they're asking for a seat at the table. It's not like they're asking for you know, realistic mm-hmm. political concessions. So we're sort of on edge because there's no good end sight where, you know, even in the Irish conflict and the Israeli conflict, and even, you know, it was, I have to be quite honest with you, it was sort of ironic that Nelson Mandela was with George Bush today, because mm-hmm. Nelson Mandela being at one stage called a terrorist by Ronald Reagan. So, you know, but at least those were people that we knew what they wanted. And we live in this unease because there's no political debate to have now. I mean, you know, of course, there are some things that maybe we could respond to with Osama bin Laden, but certainly his sort of hatred towards American Western values are hardly things that we're going to change.
So we're left in a kind of limbo. Jack Beatty, I want to bring you in. What do you think Americans are feeling as they sit on the edge of their chairs watching these TV images?
Well, it's just it's fear and apprehension and anxiety. I mean, the country has gone through this kind of thing before. I mean, the crash of 1929 brought about a whole decade, really, of pervasive economic insecurity, where people got up every morning and they weren't worried about terrorists, but they were worried about whether they would be able to feed their family at the end of the day. And it took, you know, how did people deal with it? Well, one way they dealt with it was through, you know, the government had a variety of programs that allowed people to make some earn some token money, the CCC, the WPA, and so on. But these were as much important for their symbolic quality and their therapeutic quality as for the money they gave. They gave people a sense of they can do something. There's some hope. You can keep economic insecurity at bay. But we don't have much of that now. I mean, President Bush tried, I think, in his speech last week to sort of open up a new kind of voluntarism, a new kind of citizenship, which would help people to sort of contain their anxiety and action. But that's still notional, and we don't know where that will lead. But as it is, we're sort of caught with these emotions and don't know what to do with them. The fearful thing is, you know, that fear is sort of the anthrax of the body politic. It's not good for democracy. It works against democracy. It drives people into themselves, not into public life. It's correlated with, you know, what they call mean world syndrome, the belief that the world is really like the local news depicts it all the time. Well, now the world really does seem to be that bad. And we've already seen how mean world syndrome and other things have driven people, you know, voting way down. A third of Americans already mm-hmm. say they've made major changes in their behavior. I mean, this is not on the one hand, we have the positive thing, the feeling of solidarity and patriotism. So on the other hand, we have this sort of, you know, cancerous effect of fear driving people into themselves.
Jack, let me put that to Juliet Kine. What about the mean world syndrome? Does this corrosive effect of fear of terrorism have the potential to reshape our politics in a negative way?
I think so. I mean, I think Jack has it right that there's these sort of two strains going on here. One is the patriotism, the love of America and appreciation for what America represents. And then there's this underlying thing, call it fear, apprehension, whatever, that animates people's lives in ways that I think we're just starting to understand, whether it's sort of the canceled flights or changing your holiday plans to you know, restructuring your career and your family life. And I think that that's a really difficult thing for a a government to respond to. And I have to say, you know, if this were terrorism, I think that America has handled itself pretty well in light of the devastation of September 11th. If this were terrorism, I'm not quite sure what would come next.
If it had been today. We're talking about the terror framework around today's apparent air tragedy and accident in New York. How is terrorism, the framework of terrorism, the way you see everything changing, the way you see everything going on in the world? How's it affecting you? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the framework of terror that surrounds this morning's tragedy, air tragedy, in New York. Did you wake up, see the plume of smoke over the city and think, my God, it's happened again, it's more terrorism? Millions of Americans no doubt did. How are we coping with terrorism? How is it coloring the way we see the world? Where are we in the cycle of terrorist psychology? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Juliet Kayyem. She's Executive Director of the Domestic Preparedness Program at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Juliet Kayyem, I want to ask you, judge for us the depth, the sufficiency of our anti-terror response so far since September 11th. And if this had been another incident today, and we know from our own government officials' warnings that it could well be, how are we prepared for that next hit? We had historian David Kennedy on recently, and he's looked at a lot of these heavy crises that America has gone through. And he said, you know, that our government could kind of come undone at some point before we would recover from the next blow. Do you agree? How have we done so far? How are we set to move ahead?
I'm going to speak only to the sort of domestic angle because I'm not a military expert. So here in America, I think that you're seeing sort of two responses. The local and state response, I think, has been phenomenal, in particular in New York, but also sort of September 11th sort of was a wake-up call to all these other jurisdictions that had been sort of thinking about terrorism, thinking about domestic preparedness. But for any given jurisdiction, the likelihood of them getting hit is still relatively low. I think that the 11th, if we can get any silver lining out of it, was a wake-up call for things like getting your emergency management systems in place, having point people, whether they're called czars of terrorism, getting a communication system in place, buttressing your public health system, all these important things for dealing with terrorism. On the national level, we're sort of seeing, you know, some very public power plays, I guess you would see. It's still unclear to most of us following this what or where Tom Ridge is. For me, it was sort of surprising not to see him today, mm-hmm. even though this wasn't terrorism, just because clearly most Americans were thinking about it. And I think that we do have a lot of learning to do, a lot of things to put in place. You know, we couldn't handle, let's just say, and not that I think that this could happen, but, you know, if a nuclear attack were to happen or something like that.
And we've been warned that
yes,
it could.
Yes, exactly. If something like that were to happen, I mean, the consequence, it would change not just the way, not just American history, but I think world history. And I think that we're not prepared for that because we don't know exactly how to prepare for it. A random suitcase bomb is nothing that any of our tests or lessons or anything have prepared us for. So, you know, it's no wonder that a lot of us are holding our breath right now.
We're talking tonight about the framework of terrorism that surrounds every event today. In ways large and small, it's forming the backdrop of our lives. This morning we saw a plane go down, and many people had to assume that there was somehow terror involved. We're being told all day today, most of the day, and this evening, that it wasn't. And we're grateful for that, but we're trying to examine where our psyches are right now. Where should they be? What's the right equilibrium to be on guard and yet not get overwrought about potential threats? We're joined now by James Fallows. Jim Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly and author of Free Flight, From Airline Hell to a New Age of Travel, a book about systematic problems in the airline system. Welcome, James Fallows.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us. We've thought of you today because you've written about the entire system of air travel in the U.S., and I wondered, as you looked at September 11th and then again this latest tragedy this morning, what does it bring to mind, first on the point of airline travel, how these repeated concussions may change the way we fly? And I guess in broader terms, I'd like to just get your thoughts on the terrorist environment in which everything's unfolding.
Well, in the simplest sort of operational terms about airlines, I think and fear that this last 2 months will be if not a sort of eternal, at least a very long-lasting shift in the way we think about airline travel.
Why do you fear it?
I fear it because airlines in the last, say, 10 or 15 years, although they've become convenient and part of the way we do our work, they're just sort of a utility. We take them for granted in the way we take traveling in cars. And I think it will be difficult to do that for quite a while, even if there are no further incidents, either of just simple accidents or terrorist episodes. The whole process of airline travel has become and will, I think, remain more cumbersome, slower, less convenient, less attractive. And
James Fowles, let me ask you just about that. I've flown since the 11th, and apart from seeing some soldiers with machine guns, nothing else seemed that different to me as a passenger. I didn't get there that far ahead of time. I didn't wait that long. Is it really changing?
I also took a trip this last weekend from D.C. to Seattle and back, and the difference was I made a point of leaving for the airport about an hour and a half earlier than I would have in the olden days. Mm-hmm. And it's just becoming sort of more of a planned, deliberate, and therefore sort of less convenient event than was the case, 3 months ago.
So where does that take us?
Well, I think where it takes us is in terms of travel, I think there'll be various shifts in our transportation system. I think along the East Coast, this gives a big impetus to high-speed rail, for example, and other ripple effects. There's a strange role that air travel has always played in our imagination of death and terror. It's only been the last 10 or 15 years that people sort of set aside the broad fear that if you got into an airplane, you were taking your life into your hands. It's, more people have died in car crashes since last Friday noon mm-hmm. than died today on this airplane. But still, there is this disproportionately large role the horror of air crashes holds, and I think for a lot of people, it'll be a long time before that goes away. I mean, there is a sort of poetic appropriateness to these being the instruments of terror because they've had that role in the public imagination for a long time.
Of course, it's the very sort of concentrated vulnerability that life inside a flying canister represents that makes it such a target for terrorists.
Indeed, and for the passenger, it's a sense that you're utterly out of control, that your fate, even though for the last 15 years this has been an extremely safe way to travel statistically, the reason people are afraid of it is they have sort of no individual control over their own fates once they get in.
James Fowles, hang on. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's bring some in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the framework of fear of terror that now shrouds almost everything, and especially a plane going down. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. Chris is calling from Cochranton, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, where do I stand on this? I'm thinking, I've been hearing all day, and I've been hearing you folks say that this, we have, it seems like it's a mechanical failure. Well, think back to the first anthrax victim, second and the third. We were hearing from the government, we have no evidence of any wrongdoing. Probably it's natural anthrax. What, did any of us really believe that? And I'd say no. At least I didn't after the first one.
So, Chris, you're suggesting what has kind of been floating around the studios here all day, but it's a question you hate to put out there because you want there to be government credibility. You're saying maybe it was terror and they're framing it as an accident. Why would they do that, Chris?
Well, maybe they just don't know. And I think, isn't it better to say, we don't know. It's only been a half a day. Let us find out, but don't reassure me to the point that you have to back off later and say, oops, which we don't see them doing with the anthrax, is coming back and saying, I think we probably overspoke or we said some things that probably were not accurate. It seems to be glossed over.
Chris, thanks for your call. Let me put it to Juliet Kime. Yeah. What about it? And this is so interesting. We have talked about it here today. It is of course, more... In an awful way, it's more convenient for it to be a mechanical failure today. Chris is questioning the credibility of the government when it suggests that. So, and we have, to be fair, we've had other independent authorities who've come on this show even earlier tonight and said it does look like a mechanical failure. Right. So what about the government's credibility to date? And what about the fact that Chris is questioning it in terms of our theme for the hour, which is this terror's effects beyond the news?
Well, I mean, I think Chris is right. I mean, Chris touches on, I think, the challenge for the administration, which is, as we've been hearing over the course of the last 2 months, this dual message, the sort of fear of terror terrorism, be scared, the sort of Ashcroft statements every week that we're on highest alert compared to the get on with your life. And I have to agree with Chris. I found it just, you know, I was watching TV. I was supposed to travel today. I was watching TV today. I found it kind of surprising how there wasn't anyone from the administration except for the White House spokesperson until about 4 this afternoon who came on the air. And for an administration that has been telling the American public to be on alert, to be wary, it seemed sort of a major omission for someone not to come out, whether it was Ridge or Bush himself, and just say, we don't know what it is, or we think it's mechanical, everyone remain calm. Because I think that that would put some of the questioning, some of the doubts that you're hearing from Chris, to rest a little bit, to say that the government is well aware that most Americans are a little bit, to be quite honest, freaked out by this, even if it is just a mechanical error.
Mm-hmm. James Fallows, step out of your kind of momentary specialization in air travel and give us some of your responses along the terror psyche front. You know, we're not, by reputation, an easily spooked nation. Maybe it's not as big a quake for folks as we might speculate.
I was about a week ago. I was at some program at Yale University for a day or so, and talking to a lot of students there. And they were saying how for this generation they thought this would really be the defining event of their lives, and they were trying to explain what that meant. There's a way in which I think this is a more consequential event for the American psyche, especially with this second shoe dropping today, if you will, than anything I can remember, except perhaps the assassination of John Kennedy, in the sense of learning to cope in a way with tragedy and the loss of security. I mean, again, if you were in the position of the terrorists at this moment, what you would most like would be for everyone in the U.S. essentially to lose their nerve and go crazy mm-hmm. about this. You know, whether it's an accident or whether it's terrorism, the simple cloud of doubt is the greatest victory. And in saying that, I don't want to seem like some Pollyanna, but just saying that perhaps the next step towards national consciousness is realizing there must be some way to live bravely, to live confidently, knowing there are uncertainties about our fate. So I think that may be the next sort of a more complicated process of national evolution than the simple wartime mobilization many people felt 2 months ago. Mm.
Jack Beatty, what about it? Where do you think we are on the spectrum of bravery, which we've seen on many fronts in the United States, and successful coping? And maybe at the other end is kind of freaking out or tuning out the danger.
Yeah, earlier we spoke to a young woman who said that after she turned off the television, she felt better. Well, that's a momentary feeling, of course. But television doesn't let us do that often. It's the wallpaper. It's the environment. And it's just so hard to get away from even the accidental consciousness of this, much less to sit back and say, oh, yeah, no, this just happened and that just happened. I mean, I think this has a, you know, events are in the saddle here, and that's what we're all reacting to. The whole American paradigm is the notion of mastery over history. And Southerners know that ain't so. I mean, defeat was woven into their history. Tragedy was part of what they grew up with. Now we're getting another dose of it, and we're finding out that, as Jim said, that this there is a tragic element just inescapably, and our bumptious faith in the future that things will be better, that things will work out, is a sort of frail postulate today. We just don't know, and this is a new kind of feeling, I think, for Americans.
And yet that Southern inoculation with failure or with defeat is part of our entire national conscious too. Now, maybe we're big enough to take that on board and keep on moving. And the president said last week, let's roll. And many Americans responded to that sensation as much as let's freak. We've got a caller from the South. Let's bring him on. Mike is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Thank you. I enjoy your program very much, but I'm disagreeing with you tonight. I don't think all of us have made as big a deal out of this, because character, okay? Character is, by definition, is facing adversity and moving on.
Yes, it is.
Pulling up by your bootstraps and going on to the next step. Well, the only downside of this is that our society has not instilled character into our youth. And what they are now seeing is the benefits that our fathers, grandfathers fought for it, World War One, World War Two, mm-hmm. Korea, Vietnam. I mean, these guys went over there and faced this adversity every day. They faced more than we'll ever know because they won't even talk about it, you know?
But, Mike, what is the evidence you see that some generation doesn't have that character? You know, some young people I talk to are ready to step up even maybe further than me, ready to go fight in Afghanistan.
Well, there is still an underlying character to our nation, but that's only because we have the choices that we have. They're just now understanding how much we have, you know, the fees that we have to pay for this freedom that we have.
We hear you, Mike, and we thank you for your call and keep listening and join us again. James Fallows, there you hear the voice from the South saying, hey, character is what matters, and we've got a long history of it, and let's not let go just because we've taken some repeated blows this fall.
Well, I think that may be the state of consciousness towards which we all evolve, but it is some evolution, especially from the past of the last 10 years. And essentially, there have been no national the main national problem has been concern about, you know, the distribution of the nation's wealth, and that's mm-hmm. a real issue, but it's different from the kinds of problems that we will be facing for a while to come.
Mm. Jack Beatty, you hear the response there from North Carolina saying, hey, pull your socks up, folks.
Yeah, and he was talking about young people today. Jim, I'm just interested. What did you find up at Yale talking to young people there? Was there resolve? Did you sense character there? What was it like?
It was striking to me where very few of the people who were speaking to me said they were going so far as to, you know, join the Marines or join the Army, which might in a way be realistic because there's not going to be huge manpower influxes to the armed forces, I think. But many of them were talking about what this meant about how they should spend their lives, whether public service in some form was a more important option. And many people said they were, you know, looking at the Foreign Service, the CIA, public school teaching, et cetera. So I had the sense of people taking this quite seriously as the formative event of their young lives and making them think that in contrast to 2 or 3 years ago, or as just sort of starting salaries of venture capitalist firms, that there were some other criteria they might bear in mind in choosing their next step.
Julia Kayyem, what about the structure of our emergency preparedness kind of infrastructure? What's the tone there? I mean, these are the people who are getting the spacesuits ready to go walk into anthrax sites. Do you see a methodical chin-up character-filled response there or something else?
Oh, absolutely. I think for a lot of the people that I've talked to or worked with in domestic preparedness, this is something that they have for all the unimaginable that September 11th was. This is something that some people had imagined. And how would jurisdictions respond to an event like this? So in some ways, as I said before, the silver lining on September 11th, it's given these people who have been working day to day to change the way emergency management is performed, to make modifications, to get more money for what they do. It has put them on the map, and I think that that's a good thing because for too long they've been sort of screaming out in the wilderness, trying to get the attention. And I mean, these are what we call the people who are the first responders, the very people that every moment we think of whenever we think of September 11th, the people who will run into a building or you know, go follow an airplane coming out of the sky. You know, these are people that I don't think need much more character.
We're going to have to take a quick break and say goodbye to James Fallows. James, thanks for joining us. Final thought, will we recognize our air travel system in 10 years?
Parts of it, but I think that we'll look back on this 10 years from now as the time when things changed.
James Fallows, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
James Fallows is national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and author of Free Flight, From Airline Hell to New Age of Airline Travel, a book about systematic problems in the airline industry. You can join our conversation after a quick break at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255 or online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the framework of terrorism that suddenly surrounds every development in the news in our lives. What was your first reaction to this morning's news of the crash of an airliner in Queens in New York? Did you think it was terrorism? And how is the fear of terrorism changing us? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Juliet Kayyem. from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, an expert on counterterrorism and national security, and by our own senior news analyst, Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Juliet Kayyem, let me ask you, we've been warned again and again that we should be prepared for more terrorism, for perhaps significant attacks, even, you know, the possibility of a major biological or even nuclear attack. What if this had been terrorism this morning? Maybe it's a useful scenario to use, given the ramp that we've been on in terms of how we've responded at the government level and at the national level. What responses would you have anticipated today and in the next days?
If this had been terrorism, or if it determines that it is terrorism, because we'll see in the days to come, I think when I first heard about it, let me do it anecdotally. When I first heard about it this morning and thought, oh, here we go again, as I think we all did. And my initial response was to sort of crawl up into my bed and not look, you know, sort of not want to re-embrace this, especially for those of us who are in the field. I think there would have been, or there might still be, the political ramifications, which are clearly sort of being played out right now in terms of the congressional fights over airline security and airport security. Someone would be blamed for that. I don't know
for
which
not
way.
Having passed those already.
Exactly. I'm not quite sure where it would cut. I think that there would be legal ramifications. You know, we passed a lot of legislation in light of September 11th, some of it more draconian than not, some of it pretty good. I think we probably would have seen a lot more harsher stuff on immigration, or we will start to see that, and this would have just added fuel to the fire. And then I just think for individuals, with the holiday season coming up and people really, you know, I just get phone calls because I'm in this field from friends, like, what should they do for mm-hmm. Christmas and Thanksgiving? I think that this would have been something that sort of finally changed people's minds about what they wanted to do.
Mm. A lot of people want to join this conversation. Let's turn to the phones. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What was your first reaction to this morning's news? Billy is calling from Jamaica in Queens, New York. Welcome, Billy. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I guess I'll answer your question with a question and I guess a couple of points.
We'll take them.
Firstly, of course, it is possible that it was just completely an accident, but the possibility also exists, among other things, that, you know, if it wasn't just a straight bomb, that perhaps it was even sabotage. Somebody had done something on the ground mechanically, you know, who knows where, if it was in New York or somewhere else, and just knew that at some point something would happen catastrophically.
We did have a pilot on earlier this evening who said his worst fear is what's going on under the belly of the airplane, that people are not thoroughly screened and their backgrounds aren't checked enough. So we take your point there, Billy.
Exactly. And the basic idea, it all comes back to one thing, is that since September 11th, since we finally were shown quite clearly that terrorists have infiltrated the country and intend to do damage, we're always going to, you know, we are always concerned, and we still haven't been convinced that the threat is gone. And unfortunately, like somebody mentioned before about character, and this is not, I mean, there are wonderful, wonderful Americans who do all sorts of wonderful, wonderful things. At the same time, as a general people, in many ways, were somewhat shallow, and your reporter that's on with you has mentioned, we just crawl underneath the covers and go away from it, because it's hard for us to face adversity. And while we don't have to specifically go try to challenge it, if it finds us, we have to be able to actually stand up, you know, and look at it. And because I think people don't take it so seriously, you know, we see it and we're so scared we just run away that we can't, you know, we don't realize it, you know, or we just don't bother. It makes us not take it seriously enough that we're not willing to to make certain sacrifices, even if it's going to be temporary of certain civil rights things. Just we have to be able to realize. And I personally pray, and then I live my life, you know, just as normally as I possibly can, because I cannot control things. But at the same time, I'm number one vigilant. I look around myself, and you know, without being crazily paranoid, but I you've got to be absolutely aware. And number two, I am willing to make a certain sacrifice of not just there are all sorts of sacrifices people can make, but one of them that has to be made by all of us is I think the idea that we're not going to be as free, you know, because it's basically like a cancer, and as long as it's in the country, we've got to be aware of it, and I think that as long as we're not sure that it's really fully eradicated, then we're always going to be afraid, and that's the sad.
That's where we are now.
Yeah, the sad thing is anytime anything happens, they win from September 11th because we're always concerned about the fact that it might be terrorism. It might be terrorism.
Right, and yet we can't accept that. Billy, we give your words extra weight. They come from New York, and New York has taken the hits. So we sit up and listen, yet no one wants to accept that they win. Juliet Kayyem. Billy, in particular, mm-hmm. refers to sacrifices. And President Bush talks some about this, but not in a heavy way yet. Where are we in the train of sacrifices that may have to be made? Have we begun to taste what it's really going to take to push this threat back?
I mean, on a certain level, I think yes. I mean, I think that most Americans, or at least a lot of Americans, have given up some of the things that they view as their right or, you know, as being Americans. In other words, things like travel, how we used to, the increased security in just private office buildings, all these things that are new to us as Americans. We are not used to this at all. We don't. European countries, Israel, they're used to it. We're not. And so that may not be a major sacrifice. On the other hand, you know, or maybe as Billy says, it's sort of maybe just rising to the level of an inconvenience. But it is different. It changes the way that we view our daily life. And I think the bigger sacrifices are clearly being made by our folks in the military and the first responders. And as more and more people sort of are asked to join that war, whether it's here in America or abroad, there'll be continuing sacrifices. But I think most Americans' lives feel like their lives have changed to a certain extent on the 11th.
I want to squeeze one more call in. Gail is on the line. Welcome, Gail.
Hi. Yeah. My point, I think, fits right into the context, and that is that I don't think it's necessarily the case that the government withholds information from us. That is, that this morning they suspected it may be terrorism but did not share that with us. Mm-hmm. I think that the reality is that they don't know any more than we do, and that reality is so frightening to us that it's a very difficult realization to accept as part of our day-to-day life.
Gail, we take your point. We've got to hold it there because our clock is running down. But Juliet Kayyem, this is a fascinating thing that we still have not made those critical arrests in the September 11th front. Osama bin Laden's still out there. We don't know exactly even now what the shape of this threat is or where it may lurk.
Right. That's absolutely right. I mean, the threat still continues. We are fighting a war abroad that makes us more vulnerable here. And you know, I think the American public is split between wanting its government to reassure them, tell them everything's going to be okay, and then maybe just to come out every once in a while and say, you know what, we don't know what's going on here. I actually, when Bush last week said sort of, you know, they sort of underestimated the anthrax scare, I kind of appreciated that. I thought, you know, that's absolutely right, and I sort of went from there.
Hmm.
Sorry.
Well, there we are. Juliet Kayyem, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks.
Juliet Kayyem is Executive Director of the Domestic Preparedness Program at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and an expert on counterterrorism and national security. Thanks for your calls tonight. I'll take some inspiration from Mike in North Carolina, who looks to American character, but also sympathy with our friends in New York who have taken another big blow today. You can continue this conversation on our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage for statistics on airline safety, photos, and information on the Airbus A300 aircraft that went down today. After the initial crash this morning, there was careful language and more questions than answers from local and federal leaders in New York. Here are some sounds from the day's events.
I was in my kitchen making an egg, and I saw the plane hit the house right behind my house, and then it blew up into a huge fireball, and I jumped off the second floor.
At this point, we have no reason to believe that it'll be anything else but this, but at the same time, we're sensible and we understand what happened before, so for a while, the city is going to be.
It sounded like two planes, but I guess it was
security.
Just one.
What's the first thing that went through your mind when you heard?
Oh my God! The first thing that went through my mind is, oh my God! And I just passed a church in which I've been to, I think, 10 funerals. Here,
the Transportation Safety Board is the lead investigating agency. All communications were normal prior to the crash. On the question of whether there's any terrorism, first information is always subject to change. We have not ruled anything in,
That's the way the federal government is doing it, and there's no evidence that would allow you to draw any definitive conclusion.
American Airlines is working very closely with the NTSB, but we really do not have any information that relate to the accident at all.
Any radio communications?
I had no idea.
Most of the witnesses seem to report seeing the plane separate and not seeing or hearing an explosion beforehand. There are a few contrary reports, but the plane split in a number of parts. The major portion of the plane, right in the middle of Rockaway, where 12 homes were hit, four destroyed, four seriously damaged.
They believe as part of the investigation that the pilot did dump fuel over Jamaica Bay before the crash. Which is consistent with the pilot having some belief that there was a significant mechanical failure on the plane. But the investigation obviously
this is a very difficult thing to say because the consequences so far are catastrophic. The number of people lost in this crash is appears like it's going to be even more than TWA Flight 800. So I don't mean in any way to minimize this, but it could have been far worse. Are there any number
President
of
President Mandela is going to say a few words, and I will say some after he finishes.
And it's unfortunate that that would happen at this time when the United States lost so many people on the 11th of September. But I know that you have got a strong leader, and the people of the United States of America can face disaster, and I'm sure that they will overcome this unfortunate incident. I also want to be able to express my support for the president for his action in Afghanistan.
Those who were hurt on the ground for the recent incident that took place, it is heartbreaking to pick up the phone and call my friend Rudy Giuliani and Governor George Pataki and once again expressed our condolences.
Sounds from all over America today as officials and ordinary people and Nelson Mandela respond to the latest blow to the American psyche. Jack Beatty, if there is a God, he or she has a tough sense of humor dropping this on us as a mechanical failure right now.
No, and really has it in for New York. And to think that this took place on the almost hallowed ground of this neighborhood that has lost so many people in the September 11th disaster.
They already gave it up.
Yeah, I mean, what more? As one woman said, well, how much closer can it come? You know, well, apparently right into her kitchen. And, of course, we interpret it at least initially around the vortex of fear. But let's hope that it isn't the terrorism, that it's just a catastrophic failure of an engine, as someone said. We're hearing that word a lot, catastrophic and catastrophe.
You know, somehow in that montage of sounds, I took the most comfort from Nelson Mandela's voice. I mean, there's someone who lived with, you know, decades of imprisonment and a country in a terrible situation. He saw it come out the other side. That's a voice for hope.
Yes, he's somebody who's weathered all kinds of storms and surprisingly coming out and saying he endorses the president's policy in Afghanistan.
I think that's a signal to the third world, isn't it?
I thought so, yeah. It seems so. You know, we're in a strange position. In the Second World War, there were two violent incidents against the continental United States. In one, a Japanese submarine surfaced and let a balloon go with a little bomb in it that created a fire in Oregon. And in another one, just at the time of the Hiroshima bomb, while that was going to Japan, the Japanese sent similar things on parachutes to our pathetic parachutes to Oregon to set fires. We are in a that's not the case here. These things are happening here, the anthrax, the terrorism. It's in this country. We talk about the greatest generation, but you know the homeland. They didn't have to even worry about the homeland. It is a different experience.
You know, Jack, we've had this sort of a cycle of downward surprises since September 11th, the anthrax, and now this. But I know, you know, forward-looking business thinkers talk about upside surprises. Maybe it's time to look for the real positives coming out. I'm looking.
Well, we're all looking. And the president reminds us that in the response to these disasters, we're seeing the positives. We're seeing Americans banding together and so on. Jim Fallows reminds us, young people at elite colleges thinking about public service who used to think about the bottom line.
So maybe it's there.
Maybe it's there.
Thanks very much, Jack.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up tomorrow on Special Coverage, with New York City at the center of the tragedy yet again, we'll look at how people are responding. That's